Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you're a regular listener to the program, you know what it's all about. We interview World War II veterans each week here on the program, and the idea behind that is to, first of all, honor them for their service, for the sacrifices that they've made, preserving the freedom we enjoy today. We want to record their stories for posterity so their stories will not be forgotten, and maybe along the rest of the way, some of us will learn something. We'll be inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we meet another survivor of the Battle of the Bulge, someone who was there when that infamous or famous battle began all those years ago on a frozen European continent. It's 86-year-old Dan Langpap of Fresno, California. Although I guess we got to go a little further back than that. I could say of Honolulu, Hawaii. You're not necessarily a Howley. You were born out there on the island, huh?
Yes, I was. My parents were missionaries there from 1921 to 1930, and I was born December 30th, 1924. One story about this that I relate a lot. In early 1925, the Pacific Fleet was in Pearl Harbor, and a number of the large battle wagons, including USS West Virginia, a line battleship, was there. They had open house or open ship or open boat or whatever you want to call it, where they let people come aboard. And my dad chose the West Virginia. And so my brother, my sister, my mother, and me went aboard the West Virginia. I can always say I was on a battle wagon in Pearl Harbor when Calvin Coolidge was president. I was 2 months old. I don't remember it, but my brother and sister did, and they related this to me.
And not too many people can claim that. That is a story to tell. And most of the veterans that I interview who were here on the mainland in 1941, when I asked them about Pearl Harbor and December 7th, they say they had never heard of Pearl Harbor before that day. Of course, your story is different because you had heard of Pearl Harbor. You had been there when you were 2 months old. So as we fast forward to December 7th, 1941, you're just shy of your 17th birthday. You're out here in the States. You're going to Porterville High School. What do you remember about that day? And do you think it meant more to you having come from Hawaii originally?
Well, I didn't relate it all that much living in Hawaii because I was 5 years old when we came back. But I can remember the day just like it was yesterday. A friend of mine, Gene Coe, had been working on his car. He lived about six houses down from us, and, radios weren't on all the time in those days. And so we hadn't heard anything, and I had walked down to the house to talk to him about his car, which happened to be a 1928 Chevrolet. Beautiful car today, be worth a lot of money now. But he had heard it, and he told us about it Monday, the next day. We were all called into the auditorium at Porterville High to hear President Roosevelt's speech. Porterville High, for a school in that area, was pretty large at the time. We had 1,200 students in a nice, beautiful, big auditorium. So we heard the whole goings on about Pearl Harbor that morning.
So, and I'm sure in all the years since, you've probably heard snippets of FDR's speech in a day which will live in infamy and all that many times. When you hear that, when you hear his voice and that familiar sound of an old recording, does it take you right back to that auditorium? Do you feel like you're there all over again?
Right, exactly. I can remember it just like it was yesterday, yes.
And did you have an idea at that point that maybe this was going to disrupt your life, that whatever you were planning to do, because you're a junior in high school at that point, that maybe things would be altered as far as your future?
Well, we all knew right away that before very long, we probably were going to be inducted. A few of our class of 43 dropped out of school and maybe told a little fib about their age, and they went in right then. But I thought I would wait it out and till after I graduated, and then went in induction, and on from there.
Now, I know that you are a big sports fan, and you've had a big impact on sports. And by the end of the show, we'll talk about one of the lasting legacies here in the Central Valley that has your fingerprints all over it. But I want to take a slight detour as we talk about Porterville High in the early 1940s, because sports fans from Central California might know one of the all-time great basketball players ever played at Porterville High School. Bill Sharman is in the Basketball Hall of Fame as a player and a coach. And I guess you first met him when he was a little pipsqueak trying to make the A team at Porterville High, huh?
Yes, he was on the B team when he first came in, but it didn't take long for the B coach to recommend the fact that he was really out of his class, too low, and he was up to the A team by the end of the week. And the rest is history. He scored 28 point average his senior year, 2 years later, and that was usually more points than most of the teams scored in the whole team as a unit, in a whole game as a unit. And then he went on to USC. And also about Bill Sharman that a lot of people don't know is that he lettered in baseball, football, basketball, track. He lettered in every sport that he could play in high school. So quite an athlete.
And he would eventually be drafted in baseball, too. Of course, he also served in the Navy in World War II before he ended up at USC, became an All-American, and then, of course, a Hall of Famer. One more question on him. I know he was not very tall in stature at that time when you first met him. But could you guys, even though you were a couple years older, could you see that maybe he had some real star potential in him even at that age?
Oh, yes. He was just in a class by himself as far as high school players were concerned. And really a very nice man at the time, too.
Probably fun for you later on in life to follow his career.
Yes, it was. And not exactly being a Celtics fan, but it's pretty hard not to be rooting from somebody from the Valley who made the big time.
So you're at Porterville High School. You graduate in 1943. How long did it take Uncle Sam to track you down and get a hold of you?
We got our draft notice on the day of graduation, June the 2nd, 1943. And about 2 weeks later, the group that I was in, there were about 20 of us, we came up to Fresno and took our physical and all of that. And then back by, the 10th of July, we were on our way to the Presidio of Monterey for induction, and then on to basic training at Fort McClellan, Alabama.
And did you have an idea of what you were hoping to do in the Army? Did you have any point where you could have volunteered for this direction or that direction, or did they make all those decisions for you?
Basically, my hobby was photography then, still is now, and so I signed up for something in that field, but of course, that didn't go very far because all the Hollywood draftees in the movies were getting the choice jobs like that. So I ended up in sort of a semi-officers training program called the Army Specialized Training Program, or ASTP. And it didn't go very far. So the next step up was to a combat infantry division.
Well, you say step up, but I'm sure that's not what you were thinking at the time, because ASTP was actually somewhat of a preferred position where you get to go to a college campus, right, and learn some more. And how far along in that did you get before they said, hey, we need bodies over here in Europe?
Well, I ended up with 15 units of college credit before it was canceled out. Right, I mean, immediately we were shipped out, the group, at Los Angeles City College, where our unit, our ASTP unit was, must have been about 200, and they just scattered to the four winds, and some of us kept in touch throughout the years, but that didn't last very long, and then we went into what they would call a division camp, where you'd have about 25,000 on the post, but it's all an infantry division and their support units.
So you would end up being assigned to the 99th Infantry Division, the checkerboards, huh?
That's right. The 99th checkerboard division, and I was assigned to the 394th Regiment and anti-tank company. And it's amazing how things work out. When we had arrived in Paris, Texas by train, there were about 30 of us in this group, and we were sitting there. Trucks came from Camp Maxey, and they started counting off. You go to Company A, Company B, Company this and that, and they got down to us. You three are anti-tank company, which means we weren't a rifle company, and we had trucks. And so our marching was a little bit less than the rifle companies. And also during our stint in Belgium and then in Germany, before the Battle of Jabal started and during it, the rifle companies were out in fields and foxholes, and we were able to build dugouts because we had crosscut saws and axes to build up things for our gun. So we had, under the circumstances, a pretty soft deal until the bullets started flying. I felt being an anti-tank member was a better assignment than a rifle company, because they really had it rough.
And eventually you guys would become a rifle company, but that story is still to come. We're going to go ahead and take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear more about the experiences in World War II of Dan Langpap. We'll hear what he remembers about the Battle of the Bulge from start to finish all those years ago. You're listening to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with Dan Langpap, 86 years old, a World War II veteran, served in the 99th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II, including the Battle of the Bulge. We're going to discuss more about that. Before he went overseas, he went to Porterville High School, and one of his teammates there, Louis Futrell, went on to star at Fresno State. Just passed away. He was a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, and I know there's some great sports memories from those days, Dan. And you also had some sports memories when you were heading overseas. When you guys were leaving Boston, you got to not only see a Major League game, but a pro football game and listen to the World Series actually on your way overseas?
Yes, I did. When we were at Camp Miles Standish, the port of embarkation for troops going to Europe, we had a chance to go to Braves Field, which was the most deluxe, well-constructed modern park before Yankee Stadium was built. It was built in 1915 and really a nice ballpark. The Boston Braves were not much of a team at the time, but this particular day we saw them play the Cincinnati Reds. I had wanted to see Bucky Walters, who was a great pitcher for the Reds, but it wasn't his rotation, so they had Clyde Schaun, who was 13-10 that year, pitch against Al Javery for the Boston team, a 7-19 pitcher who is really wasn't very good, but Al Javery pitched the shutout that day. And we had a great time there because everything for the troops then was on the house, and we were taken to the game and then back to Camp Miles Standish for further activities. And then later on, we went to Fenway Park to see the Boston Patriots there play a team from New York called the New York Yanks. I can't remember the score of the game, but it was an interesting game to watch, so I got to be in two Major League parks rather early in life, and we had a great time there.
Not too many people these days can say they saw a professional football game in Fenway Park. You saw the Yanks at Fenway Park. Most people would think something different when they heard that.
They would think you were at Yankee Stadium, but we weren't there at all.
You end up heading overseas, and you're a big, big baseball fan, and you're actually listening to the World Series on your way to Europe for combat?
Well, we were in Boston, and the St. Louis Browns, who had been leading the league practically all the year, and it's a team that had never won an American League pennant before, and they were one game ahead of the New York Yankees, going into the last day of the season, and they got a victory from a has-been major league pitcher by the name of Sig Jakuki, who hadn't pitched in the majors since the mid-30s, but during the war, when all of the good players were off to battle, he was able to get two more years in as a major league pitcher, and he pitched the clincher that got the Browns into the World Series against the Cardinals. We were one day out of Boston when that deciding game that won the pennant for the Browns was, and then, of course, the World Series went on. They lost it 4-2 to the Cardinals. They would post the score up inning by inning on a outside board on the troop ship, which was a Liberty ship, and you didn't have much room to get around, but everybody had to get up and see what the score of the game was inning by inning. So the World Series was over about the time we were halfway to Europe, halfway to England, I mean, before we landed.
Well, and I have to imagine that that was a good diversion for you guys to be listening to Bill Slater and Don Dunphy on the radio talking about guys like Enos Country Slaughter and Stan Musial playing in the World Series was better than thinking, what's waiting for me when I get there?
Yes, but I was thinking about hoping the Browns would beat the Cardinals because their pitching staff was outstanding. They had about a 1.43 ERA for the World Series, but their hitters just couldn't hit. And one of the highlights, I guess, or lowlights would be that the Browns used 8 pinch hitters during this 6-game series, and all 8 of them struck out. So that showed you that they were a little bit weak with the bat, but good with the pitching.
Yeah, they were a pretty big underdog back then. Thankfully, since then, a few other underdogs we know have come out on top. And I'm sure everyone listening can get a feel for your particular memory and the details that you can recall all those years ago from your attention to baseball. I trust it's going to be the same as we talk about your service in the war. What did you expect? Once that World Series ended, you probably had more time to sit around and think about what you were up against. What were you going into? Were you anxious to get over there and see what was really happening? Were you kind of nervous, afraid? How would you describe your mindset before you entered combat?
Well, you know, we were anxious to get over there, mainly to get off that ship, because it was not a very comfortable ride. We were packed in like sardines. It was not a very pleasant experience like the boys today, although they're having it very rough over in Iraq and Afghanistan. They get over there by plane rather quickly. Ours was 13 days of rough weather and seasick, but we never thought much about it. We were going into England and stay there a couple of weeks and then go across, and it never really sunk in until we actually got up there and went on the line. So we were too young really to really think anything bad was going to happen. It was just something we were supposed to do, and we were going to do it. And of course, that changed a little bit later on when things got a little rougher.
Well, let's talk about some of that, because you're not even 20 years old yet when you get there. You talked about getting to the line and being a part of the actual combat. As an anti-tank unit, what were you guys doing? What were you able to do? And how did that compare to what you thought you'd be able to do?
Well, the anti-tank unit is supposed to be able to take care of any type of vehicle that's available that's going to be what the enemy has. And, of course, the German Tiger tank was a very solid construction, and the 57-millimeter anti-tank gun didn't have much of an influence on it. However, it would work well against, you know, trucks and that. We were out, say, several times, kind of pinned down, and not to the point, we were just sort of guarding things. We didn't shoot much at the time because there wasn't any vehicles. It was mainly the rifle companies that were getting the attack on them, and they had to shoot. But the main weapon of an anti-tank crew was, if you can believe it, was a Colt 45 1911 A1, which by today's standards would be a considered absolutely useless, and almost then too. The squad leader had an M1, and the corporal gunner had an M1 carbine, but all of the rest of the crew, and there were eight of us called cannoneers, we handed up the ammunition. The 45 was our weapon. And then also in the crew, though, there were a couple of bazookas that were used by members as needed. So
when you say that the 45 became your weapon, you're saying that when you didn't have tanks to hit, or when your 57 millimeter was ineffective against the tanks, you ended up seeing foot soldiers and you'd be firing your 45?
Well, no, we ended up using M1s that we got from other sources, because the 45 was not very effective unless you were shooting at jackrabbits or something, maybe.
Last I heard, the German Army did not enlist any jackrabbits.
That's right, but the war has changed so much since then. You know, it's more or less fought at a distance now. In that, it was just combat up close. I can remember the first member of our company who was killed, and he was a squad leader, William Goodley from Pennsylvania, and his squad was down the road from us a little ways. They were in a dugout, and one of the squad members had gone outside to relieve himself. And he was just looking around, and he noticed some of the German soldiers. They had snow suits, white suits. We didn't have any of that at all, laying in the snow. And so he pretended like he didn't see him, you know. And so he went back in, told Sergeant Goodley, who was the lead man, that he saw some Germans out there in the snow, maybe a couple of hundred feet away. And big mistake, but Sergeant Goodley went charging out, said, "Let's go get him, man." He went charging out, and they just blew him away, just like that. So that was the first time that I saw somebody who had been killed, and then that's when things really started heating up.
And what did that do to you? How did you process that? Was it a shock to your system? I'm sure over time you grew to deal with it a little more easily, but at the time, was that something that was really hard for you to swallow? And
it was, because in basic training, it was just like hammer and tong. They just beat on you, and I can't say they were mean, but everything was, they just really got on you if something went wrong. And he was the first real non-com that treated me like I was a human being. That really did have an effect on me. But I was lucky. I never got a scratch. Just being stuck in the snow without overshoes and wet feet and slush, and it was the coldest winter in the Ardennes for 50 years. And finally, it just got to the point where I couldn't even walk anymore. So They pulled me back, and I was out of the war for a short time.
And I want to ask you more about that. We've got to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll hear about those frozen feet. We'll hear about Dan's story from when the Battle of the Bulge began. And by the time the program's over, we'll talk about a few of the things he's done since World War II. A lot of time has passed since then. We'll be back with more of Hometown Heroes next. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You might be saying, Battle of the Bulge again? Another week of the Battle of the Bulge? It's been a familiar pattern in the last few weeks of this program, but for good reason, because for all this time, 66 years ago, the Battle of the Bulge was raging on in the Ardennes Forest, and it started December 16th, 1944, didn't end till January 25th, 1945. So I might get a couple more Battle of the Bulge shows in before we're done with that theme this time around. We're talking to Dan Langpap. He's 86 years old. He lives in Fresno, California. But let's talk about where you were on December 16th, 1945, because there isn't a big announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, the Battle of the Bulge is about to begin. I want to hear how you realized that something was happening and what it was like from your perspective.
Well, I can remember several days before it started, and I want to relate to this, that somebody had to be out on guard duty every night. This one particular night, of course, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was so dark. And we had the anti-tank gun dug in and two kind of bunkers that we had that we could sleep in, because the unit before us, which happened to be the a unit of the 1st Infantry Division, had dug down and then had cut some logs and put on top and then a little dirt, so we were underground. But the gun was out in the open protecting a sort of an intersection. So I was out one night. I was on midnight to 8, which is a long time, but you're not doing anything anyway, so you're really just standing around looking at nothing because you can't see. 8 o'clock in the morning, what sun there was, or the light came, the sun wasn't out, but the light came, and all around me was a bunch of footprints in the snow, like somebody had been around scouting us out but left us alone. So you know who that would have been, of course. And that sort of got our hackles up a little bit. And then a couple of days later, all of this started early one morning. We had moved our gun to another location, and we were kind of pinned down where we couldn't move, but we were standing in a slushy water up to our knees for about 8 hours. We couldn't get out and just stood there in that without any, you know, no overshoes at all. So got so cold you couldn't feel your feet in anyway. And then we were able to get away from that. We had a chance to move back a little bit, and our kitchen was about a mile behind us, because we, believe it or not, we had hot meals every day up until that time, although we had K rations and C rations too. And a mortar shell had dropped in our kitchen area and killed all of our cooks and destroyed the kitchen, so we were on regular rations after that. We just made it out, and then we weren't directly in contact with the enemy for a while, although you could hear buzz bombs going over on their way to England. They came every so often, and they were really a noisy thing. I didn't know later on, until when I was back in England in a hospital, that they were still shooting these things over, and I did see a couple of them, but not in our area of London. That is pretty much the way things were at the start, and most people don't realize that even though the Battle of the Bulge was such a horrific thing, that it really didn't last very long. It was about a month, really, wasn't it? Before it was
40 days or so, yeah. Well, let's talk about you and your feet, and you mentioned that early on, you guys being the anti-tank unit were able to have dugouts to build some kind of shelter for the snow. When did that end? When did you find yourself out on your own in the snow, really with no shelter, no way to keep warm?
Just about immediately. And I was referring to that time where we could not move for an 8-hour period, and you're in. That started the problem with me. A week later, I was able to take my shoes off. Now people find out it's kind of hard to believe that you couldn't even change your clothes, any part of it, for weeks at a time. They say, yuck, you know, but that's the way it was. And so I was able to get to a fire, and my feet were itching, like itching where you can't scratch them. And so I warmed them up at a fire, and they just ballooned. I couldn't get my shoes back on. And so that effectively took me out of the war for the time being. And I was shipped back to a hospital in Viviers, Belgium, and then a hospital train on to through Paris to Le Havre. And we had a channel steamer, hospital ship, British hospital ship, back to England. And then eventually ended up at a big hospital plant in Carmarthen, Wales. And the amazing thing about that trip across on the Channel hospital steamer was the fact that, as rough as the English Channel is usually, you know, it's usually the water was glass smooth. There wasn't a ripple. And that was amazing to me, because usually the English Channel is very, very rough. One of the breakfasts we had on board was cold sweetened tea and cold boiled eggs. I guess that's the English way of doing it. But the crew was very nice to us when we went.
I got to ask you, when you're taken off the line because your feet are frozen and you really can't get around anymore, are you relieved that you know you're not going to be as much in harm's way? Are you kind of remorseful that you can't be there with these guys you've been serving with? What was your mindset at the time?
When they took me back to the aid station the first time and the doctor looked at my feet and said, well, you can't stay around here. It was evening time and they put me off in a tent all by myself. And, man, I felt just awful. You know, I said, man, all my pals, we'd played softball together. And all of a sudden, I wasn't there anymore. But, I felt remorse. But then again, I felt not so concerned about standing out in all that lousy weather again. It was mainly the weather that was so bad. Because it's amazing at the time that young people, and see, I was 19 years old at the time, that they don't think they can get hurt. Invincible, just like the kids now driving cars. You know, they get in that thing, nothing's ever going to happen to them. And sadly it does. And sadly it did then. And the boys over in Iraq, the part that really, really bothers me, you know, is getting shot is one thing, but getting blown up is something else. I can't even picture roadside bombs as a part of war.
Because it's so cowardly?
Oh, it's a cowardly, dastardly act, but that's just the way they do.
Well, and in your case, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you talk about chances of survival. Did you ever, either then or maybe in all the years since, look back and say, maybe having frozen feet actually saved my life? Maybe that was the best thing that ever happened to me?
Well, I would say it probably did, although I wasn't thinking of it at the time. Another thing that and we all kind of laughed about this was before we left Camp Maxey to go ahead towards Boston and overseas, that we all had to make out our wills. And my mom, I remember, she died in 1968, and she'd given me all this packet of stuff she'd had for years that I'd sent home. My last will and testament. Now, you know, we never thought, why do we need this for?
You're 19 years old, and you're making out a will.
Yeah, we're just going over there for maybe a year, and we're coming back home, and that's it. Doesn't work out that way. But I was thinking that with that will, if I hadn't gotten it back before I got married and something happened to it, they would have everything and my wife would have nothing. So we've laughed about that too. So I tore that rascal up.
Sounds like a good idea. One more thing before we catch a last break here. I know you don't want to complain about it or aren't looking for an overwhelming amount of sympathy or anything, but just so our listeners understand what this has meant in your life. Having frozen feet 66 years ago is not something that just happened then and went away. This is something you've had to live with since. What have been the after effects and the lingering effects of what you endured at the Battle of the Bulge?
The after effects of the frozen feet meant that they've had some sort of achy feeling practically my whole life. Of course, they were not considered a battle injury at the time, and not until about 12 years ago when the Korean vets were complaining because they went through the same thing, only probably maybe a little worse because it went for a longer period of time. And they got some, Congress finally came through with something for them, and then someone spoke up that, well, how about the World War II vets? So I wrote up a letter and sent it in. Eventually, I got an answer, and they said, well, come in, let us look at you, and then they assigned me to a doctor downtown for a physical examination, and I went down there, and they had me standing in buckets of water with ice in them, you know, and a strange thing happened, and I didn't realize this, that I would stand in this water for about 5 minutes, which really did not feel too well, but it affected the foot that wasn't in the water at the same time. And then I'd change it, and vice versa. He said, this is just something that happens. And so I forgot all about it. A letter came. This letter came about 3 days before Christmas, and it was there, and I hadn't even opened it up because get stuff from the VA all the time. And so my wife said, well, why don't you take a look at this? And so I opened it up on Christmas Day and said that I was going to get 60% disability. Kind of a nice Christmas present anyway.
And well earned with all those years of frozen feet, which didn't stop you from playing baseball and football at Porterville College when he came home from the war. We're going to talk more about that when we come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes straight ahead. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. All month we've been focusing on the Battle of the Bulge with men who were there. Men who, like Dan Langpap today, suffered frozen feet there, was taken off the lines in late December of 1944, missed the rest of the Battle of the Bulge, recovering in hospitals, ended up all the way back in England in a hospital. Eventually, you were cleared to go back. And I understand that you have a very specific memory about the day that you walked back onto French shore at Le Havre. Something else happened that day that makes that stand out in your mind.
Yes, we had just gotten off the LST, and we were walking up this hill. There was a camp up at the top of the hill where we were going to stay a couple days. And that's the first time that I heard that President Roosevelt had died. So that was really towards the end of the war, but we were still going up back to our units. And I got there a few days later, but the war was over when I got back to my unit.
When you guys heard the news that President Roosevelt had died, how big of a deal was that to you there? Because here's the guy that you had heard on the radio talking about Pearl Harbor when you're sitting as a Porterville High Panther in the auditorium. Here's the guy who's been your leader throughout the war. Was that a major impact on all of you to hear that news?
Well, it was, but we talked about it a little bit, but there was so much more going on around us that we just took it as part of the war, you know, and that it had happened, and then we would just move on. But it was a shock, yes.
And a lot of the veterans that I've talked to have images that stick in their mind. For some, it's especially prisoners of war. When they got back and they sailed past the Statue of Liberty, a very emotional moment. I've talked to others who were part of the D-Day invasion, and they looked out and saw ships everywhere they could see, and just the magnitude of that struck them. I think you have a moment like that, too, when you're on your way back to join your unit, something that really stands out in your mind?
Yes, we were at a town of Stolberg, Germany, and everywhere the Army goes, you have to have PE at some time or other, and we were up on top of this hill, like a related sort of a Sound of Music type hill. And we were doing our PE, and then all of a sudden, this huge flight of American bombers, B-17s, B-24s, came over heading in the direction of Berlin, and it took them about 15 minutes to pass over. There were planes from horizon to horizon, front and back and sideways, and it was really a spectacular sight, because they were flying fairly low, maybe 5,000-6,000 feet, and they were gone for a couple of hours, and then here they came back again, because there was very little anti-aircraft fire and no fighter planes at all protecting the German capital, and so it was really a spectacular sight. A few of them came back limping with smoking engines or so, but the majority of them just came back the way they had gone by a few hours earlier. Very spectacular, and I'll never forget that.
And it probably gave you a little bit of an inkling that it wasn't going to be long till things were all over with, huh?
We pretty well were sure that the war was close to being over, even before we landed coming back over.
Where were you when you heard the war was over, and what did it mean to you?
I know where I was when the first atomic bomb was dropped, and so we were close to it, so I was still there. I had a 10-day leave to a town in France called Nancy, France, so we had gone there by truck, and I was there when the bomb was dropped. You know, I really can't put a marker on the day, although I can put a marker on what we were going to do after VE Day, what they were planning for us to go to Japan by way of the Mediterranean and Suez Canal and that.
So really, VJ Day was probably a bigger day for you than VE Day, because that meant you weren't going to have to go to Japan.
That's right. We thought about that a lot, because they were already talking about the kind of material we would need, and we were getting all set up for that. Walt Disney had prepared a short cartoon movie, Where Do We Go From Here? I saw it then, but I've never seen it since, and they were explaining what was going to happen to the European troops who were going to be going to Japan. I wonder if it's still in existence in anywhere. But they showed us the whole thing, and we were prepared for it. Of course, at that age, you're thinking, well, here's another adventure for us. We're going to take another boat ride through the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal and all that stuff. But they cut that off right away, and then things just settled mostly back to normal.
And thankfully, most of your adventures were back here in the United States, and we won't have time to cover all of them, but I want to cover a couple. And I want to ask you, when you did get home, and here you are, you're 20, 21 years old, you've been through what a lot of people would describe as hell and survived it. What was your outlook? Did you feel like you had a new start? Did you feel a responsibility that you better make something of yourself because of all the guys who died back over there? What was going through your mind, and how did you approach life from there on?
Well, we had the GI Bill facing us, so I got right into that. I had 2 years at Portola College, then went on to Fresno State, and I didn't go right straight through Fresno State. I took a couple semesters off in the middle because I'd gotten married, and I was working in a winery for a while, that Italian-Swiss winery on Clovis Avenue, sampling grapes that came in on the trucks and things like that. So finally, I went back and picked up the loose ends and got my degree in 1953. But in the meantime, even after being in the service, after I left Portola College and came to Fresno State, I signed up for Air Force ROTC, ended up getting a second lieutenant's commission from that, also involved in the first annual drill competition they'd never had with the Air Force ROTC unit before. And my group, which was Flight 2 Squadron A, won the drill competition. So I got a little trophy to take home from that.
And I've seen a picture of that, too, that I'll make sure we post online.
Graduated from Fresno State, and I had a degree in poultry husbandry, but I changed courses and got into education. Started teaching school in 1953 at Teague Elementary in Highway City, 4 years there. And then I went to, signed on at Fort Washington Lincoln School, which later became a part of Clovis Unified. It was part of the Clovis High District. And I was there when the district unified in 1960, and I spent my last 30 years in Clovis Unified. And at the same time, getting involved early, because as a neophyte district, all the administrators had to extra assignments. So I picked up on one. I was given a language arts assignment. And so I started a speech festival and a spelling contest. The speech festival is still going to this day. The spelling contest is not. But then Dr. Buchanan brought tackle football to the elementary schools. The parents were a little upset about their little boys getting hurt, being tackled. So I came up with an idea that might promote it, and I call it the Elementary School Football Carnival. And we had 8 schools the first year. Now there are probably about 40. And they played each other one quarter, and they rotated it so each school would play maybe 3 or 4 others as a spectacular thing, which it turned out to be, because we were ending up with over 1,000 football players playing and maybe about 1,500 cheerleaders, all on a Saturday morning in the space of about 4.5 hours, and it really became a great big deal.
And still is to this day.
And still is. I know a number of NFL players that have played in it. Probably every NFL player that went to Clovis Schools played in the football carnival, and I can, right off the top of my head, relate Billy Volek, Carson Palmer, who went to sixth grade in Clovis Schools before he moved away, and David Carr. They all played in the Clovis Elementary Football Carnival. It had been a real big event for the young kids in Clovis.
And that's quite a legacy that you've built there, and something that has continued to grow, and something you should be very proud of. And speaking of, one more question for you. As someone who spent his career in education trying to impart something to these younger generations who were coming through, I don't know how often you got a chance to share anything about your experiences in World War II. But if you had a student that came up and said, World War II, what was that all about? Why were you guys over there? What should I know about it? I know that's a hard question to answer succinctly, but if there's one thing that you want future generations of Americans to know about you and the guys like you, what would that be?
Well, World War II came along, and practically everyone who was physically fit was in the service during World War II. They could be Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, whatever. But it's a job that had to be done because we were on shaky ground to start with. We didn't know whether we were going to even win the thing. Although, amazingly, I believe the Japanese knew that they probably couldn't win the war, but it was something that they figured was kind of forced on them. But we knew that, as I believe as Admiral Yamamoto said, the United States is the sleeping giant. And the way we organized for that with the big businesses, manufacturing, everything, the home front, and 12 million service people going at it, and building Liberty ships, some of them in as short a time as a week, and building all these ships that were built only if they got one trip out of them, they were worth the cost. It really made the United States what it is today, and the fact that the GI Bill made it possible for all of the veterans to get the education or any way they wanted to use it to make things so great. And that's where Tom Brokaw came up with the Greatest Generation. And I think we really accomplished what the government had set out for after the war was over.
Well, I think you said that very well, and I have nothing to add or subtract from that. Dan, I want to thank you for serving our country, and thanks for sharing a few of our stories with us.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed every moment. I hope I've said the right things, and I've really enjoyed doing this.
And when the microphone's off, we can sit around and talk some more baseball. Sound like a plan?
Very good idea, except the St. Louis Browns aren't around anymore.
No, they're not. The Cardinals have a monopoly on St. Louis now. That has been our program for today. Dan Langpap of Fresno, California, our guest. If you want to see what he looks like, check out a picture at our website, kmjnow.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.